Welcome to the Judo Edit podcast, where I chat with key athletes, coaches, and influential people to take you behind the scenes of the international judo circuit. I hope you can laugh at their stories, learn from their experiences, and hopefully find some gems to improve your own judo. In this second episode, I speak with Ivica Pavlinic, a Croatian-born Kiwi who's represented New Zealand around the world since he was a teenager. He's got a great mix of ridiculous stories and honest advice, and we dive pretty deeply into what shaped him as a judoka. I'd also like to thank Judo New South Wales for supporting this podcast. If you're interested in learning about judo or starting a club, go to judonsw.com.au. Welcome to the Judo Edit podcast. We're now up to episode 2. And today I've got Ivica Pavlinic, who's been world number 12, international athlete, Commonwealth Games athlete, and has had a top 7 finish at the World Championships. Hey Ivica, how's it going?
Hey, good. Top 9 finish.
Top 9 finish?
Yeah,
okay.
Top 7. I wish.
He's also pretty humble. just so that we can get a feel of your background and what you've done in judo, tell us about how you started.
Well, I just started in a small club in New Zealand, Palmerston North Judo Club, and I only just did it because my brother was doing judo. I've got an older brother. I was born in Croatia, and he got into judo in Croatia because he fell out of a tree and he broke his arm, so my parents wanted to toughen him up, so they put him into a fighting sport. Yeah.
Wait, he fell out of a tree? And then
broke his arm. That's why they put him into judo. Yeah, the rationale. This is Eastern European.
That's a great story. And then how did you get full blown into that?
I'm not really sure, but I think I was just jealous that my brother was doing it, so I just kind of followed him, and that's where it started.
Pretty good, pretty good. And how old were you?
I was 7.
7 years old. Okay, yeah. Cool. And so, in terms of your career, did you have any highlights or anything, any memorable moments?
There's a few. The World Championships, that was a good day. That was in 2013, that was a good day. Getting 2 points at World Championships is pretty,
yeah.
It's a good feeling. But there's been other ones, like, there was a competition in Taipei where I fought really well and unfortunately lost in the semi-final. And there's other ones like my first national title in New Zealand and my first Oceania title. And yeah, things like that. Even just winning and there was one in 2005. It was my first World Cup that I ever fought in. And I got a bronze, and that was a highlight. Yeah.
Nice. So do you remember your 2 points at the World Championships, do you remember how those fights went or who it was against?
Yeah, the first one, I had a good draw, but you still had to win. The first fight was against Malot, again from Central African Republic. So it was a good draw, but he's not bad. He's a full-time athlete, lives in Spain. And got a Yuko with Uchimata, just a small Uchimata. And then,
which would be a Wazari now.
Yeah,
which is great.
Yeah, back when I started judo, it was Kokas, but yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, and leg grips, but never mind.
Oh, good old days.
Yeah, so I think I got a Yuko, and then shortly he opened up a bit more, and then I got underneath him in a Senagi. That was a Nippon.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, and then the other one was against Fernandez from America, from USA, and that was like a 10-second fight. Yeah, I just Katagaruma for a pen.
Katagaruma, what year was this?
2013
World Championships. That sounds like it's a video worth looking up.
that was a good moment.
Yeah. Well, I'll try and find that and put that in the show notes. So in terms of your training, you mentioned that your brother was the one that started you off, but you've mentioned Sean Choi before.
I haven't seen him in years, but he was my training partner from about age 14. He moved from Korea. He's Korean, but he lived in Fiji for like a year, then he moved to New Zealand, and he moved to my club. And from then we were training partners from when I was about 14 till I was about 21, I'd say. So it's a good 7 years we trained together every day. And he was better than me, so made me better, and his technique was really good, and made me push myself and stuff. So yeah, he was really a big input in my judo, actually.
Yeah. So in terms of how valuable that is for like young player to have a training partner that's really pushing them, what's sort of your take on that?
Definitely it is a motivation. If you're the best at a club and you're training, you know, there's no one's pushing you. Whereas if you're second best, you know, if you're third best, and there's a couple of guys that you can aspire to and look up to and follow, I think, yeah, it's a big help. It's not impossible to do without it, but it does help.
Yeah.
I mean, at the same time, the way Sean and I trained, we trained a lot and we trained hard, but at times it wasn't the smartest training that we were doing. Like,
right. What do you mean by smart training?
For example, we only had really each other to train in, and we would just do randori against each other. But then, like, if you have two people just constantly doing randori with each other, you just get used to each other, you just get conditioned to each other's judo, and what happens is you become experts at finding the other person.
Yeah.
Because you end up, you know, stalemate every time. So we didn't, looking back on it, we should have done like situational randori where like one of us goes left-handed or one of us is attacking, the other's defending, mm-hmm. things like that. Yeah.
That's an interesting observation given that clubs around Australia and New Zealand do have quite a small,
Yeah, actually, I just wrote a report about situational randori for New Zealand judo a few months ago and sent it out. Hopefully, it's been spread around the clubs, but I don't know yet.
Yeah. The fact that, you know, Sean was your key training partner, did that become a limiting factor in terms of, is that why you moved across from New Zealand to Sydney?
Well, not really. Like, it was a limiting factor in where we were. Well, actually, that same year, I got a scholarship to go to Uzbekistan for training. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening is I was about to go to Uzbekistan, and my dad had just moved to Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved to Melbourne to get a little bit extra training before I went to Uzbekistan. That's kind of how it happened.
So one of the things I really find interesting about your story is that you've literally trained around the world. You mentioned Uzbekistan, like it's a casual place that everyone goes to. What's Uzbekistan like? Why was it like Uzbekistan and not Germany or Canada or any other place in Europe?
Well, that wasn't my decision. That was the IGF scholarship. The year before, I applied for the IGF scholarship and I didn't get it, and it was in Paris.
Yeah.
And then the year that I got it, it was in Uzbekistan. So the deal is that Uzbekistan had opened like an Olympic training center, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, they were sending athletes in. So yeah, I was the one who wanted to go there.
And so was that your first time training internationally?
No, I'd been to Japan a few times before that.
Right.
And I've been to Europe before that as well.
Right. So how long were you in Uzbekistan for?
I think three months.
By yourself?
I had a couple of, one Kiwi and one Aussie with me. I assume Kiwi called Mark Brewer was with me there for a while, and Mark Anthony, who's a London Olympian for Australia.
Yeah.
And Beijing Olympian maybe. Yeah, two-time Olympian. He was there with me as well.
Good mix of people. So
yeah, I was their translator.
Really? You can speak Uzbekistan?
No, I can't speak Uzbek, but I can speak like a tiny little bit of Russian, whereas they can mostly barely speak English, but yeah.
Right. So in terms of training camps, and at the moment there's a Midasil training camp which just finished. What was your experience like going to training camps overseas, and how did that sort of compare to training in Australia and New Zealand?
Actually, speaking of Midasil, that's one place I never went. I was just never in Europe at that time. But yeah, it's just a different level. Like, for example, when you do randori anywhere, pretty much, when you're competing internationally, you do randori in Australia or New Zealand, anywhere, you're looking at getting thrown maybe twice in a whole training session.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're training international training camp, you're looking at getting thrown more than twice in every rank time. So
Or maybe we should take a step back. Could you explain the format of international training camps or how it runs?
Well, it's pretty simple. Generally speaking, you've got a training session in the morning and a training session in the afternoon. And generally, you do your 10-minute warm-up, 10-minute personal Uchikomi, and then you do your own warm-up, own Uchikomi with your training partner, and then they just put the clock on 20 times 5 minutes or 20 times 4 minutes, or if they're going to do, Neiwaza, then it's like 10 times 5 minutes Neiwaza, so you do, or 8 times 5 minutes Neiwaza, and then 20 times 5 minutes Tachiwaza. So it's just like, there's no technical, of course, because, you know, everyone there is already an international athlete that they've got their own technique sorted. And you just fight. And you do that once in the morning, once in the afternoon, generally in between you sleep.
You literally eat, sleep, do, repeat.
Yeah.
So did you have any, like, you know, memorable times when you've thrown someone, you know, one of the big names at a training camp or, you know, any good fights?
Actually, I've got a funny story about this. So I was doing it was a training camp in Tokyo, and I was doing randori with Wang Ki-chun, who's a silver medalist at Olympics, and I think to a three-time world champion. And, you know, we're doing randori, and, you know, I throw him, and he throws me. And then, because my training partner, Sean Choi, who we mentioned earlier, was Korean, he asked Wang, "Oh, my Kiwi mate threw you." And Wang just said, "So what, I'm world champion." It's like, the thing is, it doesn't matter. He doesn't have any issues about getting thrown around randori because he's already proved himself.
Yeah.
That was a kind of funny experience and realization that, you know, you do as much randori as possible to get better, but, you know, if you get thrown randori, it doesn't mean too much.
Yeah.
Like, actually, this morning I was coaching someone, and he's a green belt, and he actually threw me in randori. I said, "Congrats!" And he legitimately threw me. I tried something, and he counted. So I, you know, it's randori. Yeah.
Yeah, and then what matters is, you know, on the day.
Yeah. If you're throwing everyone in randori, but in competition you freeze and you can't beat anyone, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of competing internationally at some of the really big competitions, what would your the day of your competition look like? How do you sort of prepare yourself to fight? What's your warm-up look like?
I wake up, generally before breakfast, I watch some kind of, well, not a whole movie, but some kind of scene out of like a movie like 300 or some kind of like inspirational sports movie.
What's your favorite inspirational sports movie?
There's quite a few. I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Okay. Was a tangent anyway. Back to your competition day, you just wake up and watch your inspirational scene.
Then my breakfast, generally a high protein breakfast because protein makes you focus. Get to the venue, do a bit of a stretch. Then probably an hour before you're about to fight, before I'm about to fight, I start warming up. This directly going to contradict what I said earlier, but I'm going to tell yourself, it's just a randori, you know, get yourself in the right mind frame to fight.
Right, is that sort of to make sure that you're not getting overwhelmed by pressure? Or?
Pretty much. The way I kind of rationalized it to myself was, you know, I perform well in randori, so this is just like randori, nothing's different. In terms of what everyone does before they fight, I think everyone's different.
Yeah.
You know, I see guys spewing in the toilets before they fight. I see guys just laughing, having a joke around before they fight. So, yeah, everyone's different, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for me, I was trying to get into like a really calm but really aware state, and then like I had a little mental kind of drill thing that I did. Yeah.
Mental drill in terms of like visualization or?
Yeah, visualization. Just I pretty much envisioned in my head was a coffee plunger, a coffee thing, and just as the plunger went down, it flushed out all the negative thoughts.
Oh, right.
Out of my head, and then I filled them with positive thoughts, and like, yeah. So that was just me.
Oh, that's really cool. Never heard of that analogy before. So really good.
Yeah, it was actually it was given to me by a sports psych, and he kind of recommended me, and it worked.
Awesome. So did you have any role models growing up that you sort of looked up to within judo or outside of judo?
Yeah, I had a few guys. Like, there's a few guys who were in the New Zealand team when I was quite young.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 12 or something. I'd see them fighting, and you know, just competitions in New Zealand, and it'd be awesome, and you know, to be beating everyone just easily.
And then
like as I got older, you know, I end up doing randori with some of them, which is quite good. Like,
did you beat any of them in that?
You know, someone I used to look up to this guy called Ben Pilley. He's always a, yeah, I was 11, you know, he was winning New Zealand titles.
Yeah.
He had amazing judo. And then, like, he made a kind of comeback to judo when I was about 18 or 19.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did randori, and I'd be throwing him, and I'm like, what's going on here? And it's kind of, the cool, it's a real moment, but a cool moment.
Yeah. I also hear that you've got a pretty good story of the first time you beat Tin, your brother.
Oh, that was a long time ago. That was just like a club champs, I think. Pretty much, I was like 16 or 17, I think. I think I'd just come back from that World Cup that I mentioned earlier where I got a bronze, and it was my first international comp, really, in seniors. Yeah, I was fighting him, and yeah, I think I just won a small score, Coca. So I'd beaten him a few times, but then he actually won the last one, which is funny. It was a Mexican team event, so you win, you stay on, and you fight until you lose, and then the next one in your team comes in until the last man standing in the team, or whichever team runs out of players first loses.
Yeah, and just to clarify, this is open weight.
Yeah. He was in a different club then because we moved to Auckland while I was still living in Hamilton in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an inter-club team event. And I beat the first two guys from his club. And yeah, and then I was already tied. And oddly enough, the referee was from his club as well. he legitimately choked me out. Yeah, which is...
Was it like you tapped out, or were you just like, no, I can't take the...
No, I tapped.
Okay.
I was tired.
Yeah. you knew when it was over.
It was an important competition, but the club that he fought for was Judo Choir. I think apparently that story of, like, loyalty for the club, that even he beat his brother for the loyalty of the club, is still spoken around Judo Choir these days.
Oh, it's become a legend.
Yeah, he's like... That was kind of his most revered moment for Judo Choir.
Right, but that was how long ago?
I think it was like 2008, 2009.
So literally 10 years ago, and he hasn't fought you since.
No,
he's going to retain that title.
Yeah, it's going to stay forever. Yeah, he's got one over me for life, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I suppose when you finished up uni, you became a full-time athlete, is that right?
Yeah.
So what was that like? What was your day like? How did you train?
So pretty much you wake up, you go to training. When I first finished uni, I was training three times a day when I was at uni, to be honest. But, you know, you wake up, you train, and normally I'd go to uni, but this time I'd go back to sleep and rest. And wake up, train again, then have lunch, then, you know, wake up, go back to sleep after lunch, wake up, train again, and then have dinner. So, yeah, you just train.
It sounds like there'll be training camps at the beginning.
But, you know, it's kind of, it's a bit different because you're not just doing judo, you're doing gym and you're doing conditioning as well.
Right.
Sprints and stuff like that, running.
So yeah. I do want to come back to the thing you mentioned about gym, but in terms of moving from, you mentioned doing three sessions a day at uni, and then afterwards when you finished uni, it was the same, but you just sleep instead of classes.
the training intensity increased.
Especially
overseas.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was going to also ask, did you feel, or did you see, like, a significant increase in, like, you know, performance in your judo with the additional rest, or...?
That's a hard question to answer. I didn't really see it because I was training with better people because I was in like stronger judo countries. So I don't know that I don't know that I did see that much performance increase.
So would you say it's like an imperceptible increase, given that your whole entire standard of training just
There's moments when you the moments where you do realize that oh yeah okay this train's paying off. They're generally not at training. I think they're in competition when you like you perform well. You don't even need to win a fight, but if you perform well and you like give someone a challenge, someone who's top in the world, you give them a challenge and you're all right. Well, you know, I'm making steps in the right direction.
So in terms of
competition performance, I think that's where you can see. Rationalize to yourself and see to yourself that what you're doing is working.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And so throughout the year, how many days? I won't ask you but exact number, but like percentage wise, how many days were you like not at home, so not in New Zealand or not at what you consider your home base?
For me, it was a lot. In 2013, I was probably 7 months out of my home base. 2014 was probably 6 months.
Yeah.
2015 was probably a bit less than 2015, 5 months. There was a funding issue there for a while.
Yeah.
And 2016, I was away until I retired.
Yeah. And that sounds like a very extensive time to be, you know, away from home. How did you, like, keep yourself upbeat?
Oh,
because you're a very positive person, from what I've known of you.
Yeah, sometimes I wasn't that positive in that situation. But you just kind of know what your goal is and you know what you have to do. I mean, I didn't end up reaching all my goals at all. But and you get used to it. You get used to not having a home. You learn to live like that, I'd say. You adapt.
But it's worth it because you've got a purpose behind it.
Yeah, you're motivated because you know this is what I want to do, this is what I have to do to get what I want.
Before you mentioned that around 2012 when we were talking about Sean Choi that you'd just come back from an injury. Would you be willing to elaborate on, you know, what caused the injury and how it shaped you as a judo player?
So it was off season in New Zealand. I think it was like the 20th of January. So I was out with some friends for drinks. I got attacked from behind. Someone hit me with a piece of wood or a bat or something, and I had a brain hemorrhage. I woke up in hospital, had to stay in hospital for a few days, and then, pretty much I couldn't do a competition for about 14 months. Probably after about a month, I was on the mat doing just a chikomi and stuff like that, and probably after about 5 months, I was doing light randori. There's a few things that happened. First of all, you kind of like, just happy to be doing judo. You're happy to be alive. You know, I could have died. So, you know, it's, you know, you're kind of happy to be enjoying judo, which is the first step.
Yeah.
And then, like, you just kind of, have to adapt and find new ways to train. Like, you can't do randori, so I'm like, okay, all my major techniques are right-handed. Maybe I should develop a left-handed technique. So for, like, I think for about 12 months, I was doing left-handed ushikomi.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening, three competitions back, 2012, three competitions into 2012, I was fighting someone, I tore my meniscus, so I couldn't turn in left-handed anymore.
So in terms of, I suppose, competing after that injury, was it tough coming back to the same level of competition? Or?
I don't know, I think it made me more focused. It was just a setback, you know, everyone gets setbacks and then you reevaluate and you keep going forward. I'm a pretty positive person.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people helped me. Like, I had a girlfriend who, she was really good at that time when I was injured. So, you know, things like that. Parents were supportive.
Mm.
So it kind of all built back into it, and it kind of makes you tougher as a person, I guess, emotionally tougher, and and you kind of know what you sacrificed beforehand. It's kind of taking one training session at a time, one day at a time. Does that answer that question?
It does. Yeah. And actually, you mentioned something there about having people around you supporting you, and injuries are usually quite common in judo. So for, I suppose, the people listening who aren't maybe the direct judo athletes, maybe their parents or maybe their friends of a judoka who's injured, how would you say it's best for them to support their child or their friend or whatever?
Oh, just keep them positive. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like, don't let them stop believing in their dreams, I guess. And also tell them, one big thing is when people are injured, they stop training completely. If you can still train, you just got to limit yourself. And I think, letting them do something so they can feel progress. I think just a positivity goes a long way if you're a support person.
That makes a lot of sense. So throughout the course of your career, did you have any key life lessons that you sort of learned or picked up on?
There's a few things stay positive no matter what happens. That was part of with the head injury. You just want to you want to go into a downward spiral, but you kind of want to keep positive. And even, some days when in Europe, when you're training and, you've had 3 competitions in 3 weeks and you've lost first round every competition, and you just want to sink into a hole. You don't want to be alive, sort of thing. And you just need to stay positive and just keep looking forward and not dwell on things. So that was one thing. Another thing is learning how to, the reality of life is that it doesn't always go as planned, and I narrowly missed out on the Olympic Games, so you kind of have to kind of think, okay, yeah, maybe it didn't work out, but that's okay, what's next, and being able to handle disappointment in a way. Unfortunately, in judo, if you look at a competition, take for example any competition, you've got three guys in a weight, or girls in a weight category, who have won their last fight. The person who came second, the person who came fifth, seventh, ninth, so on, they all lost their last fight. So there's only a very minute number of people who have won their last judo fight. So that's a big thing. Losing is a part of judo, unfortunately, a part of all sport, I guess. And just being able to pick yourself up from that and just focus on, put it aside and focus on the next thing.
Mentally, how, if you've just come through a loss, maybe you came fifth or something, just lost your last fight. Or actually, say you've just lost your third round fight where you're disappointed in yourself, but then you've got to back it up with a record charge fight and an opportunity to get to a bronze medal. How do you turn that around?
That's hard. Hopefully you've got a coach there with you. Sometimes I didn't have coaches with me, but hopefully someone just tells you, scratch that. Scratch everything. You just fight on. Don't worry about what happened. It's the first round again. And that's one thing. One thing now, I'm a coach. One thing I say to athletes, even if it's the final, I say to them before they fight, okay, it's the first round over again. Just reset your mind, like it's the first round. Like you're just getting ready to fight.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of in terms of mental preparation for fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Or for sport in general, it doesn't matter what happens, you know what you have to do going forward. So one person, she recently failed a drug test, so you shouldn't really look up to her or mention her, but Maria Sharapova, if you look at her playing tennis, it doesn't matter what happens in the previous point, she's got the same expression going forward. So that's you know, the past is the past. All you can do is focus on what's next.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same.
Yeah. Oh, that's also very interesting that you brought up tennis into that now, because I've always sort of seen tennis as a very extended almost version of judo where, you know, you've got your breaks and you have to reset again.
Yeah. And it's kind of is in you're on your own.
Yeah.
You're on your own. Even if it's like, if it's a team event in judo, you're really still on your own on the mat. If it's a team event or like Davis Cup or whatever in tennis, you're still playing on your own. Apart from in doubles, but it's
different. Yeah. But doubles isn't really tennis. Yeah. I hope there are no tennis players listening, sorry. I offended you. This is a question I'm actually borrowing from one of my favorite podcasters, Tim Ferriss. Has there been any bad advice that anybody has given you?
Oh, tons, yeah.
Like, they've given it with all the best intention, but...
There's tons. Like, in terms of technical stuff, you know, if someone's old school, they're like, no, you don't change your grip here, you know, in the 50s we did a CNI like this, you can only do CNI like this. So yeah, the thing is, my philosophy on advice is listen to everyone's and, you know, take what works for you. No two human bodies are the same, so no two things are going to work the same.
Mm-hmm.
And no two human minds are the same, so I'm open to all advice, but, you know, sometimes you're going to get bad advice.
So how do you filter that and realize this is not something I want to follow? What's your process there?
I don't really know.
You just know.
It's just kind of, it's like when someone tells you something, you kind of think about it, and then you, in judo something, you just think about it and you test it and you go, oh yeah, that works. Or you go, oh, that's a crock of shit. Sorry, pardon my language. But I think in judo that's the best way to do it, just test it for yourself. But then again, there's different kinds of learners. Some people are theorists, some people are active learners. So for me, if I see something taught, I try it and see if it works. And then like recently I was training in Sydney at a club and they had a guest and he was showing a technique and I was like, okay, this looks really strange. And you know, I did it and it felt like the most awkward thing in the world. And he goes, yeah, that was perfect. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, I'm not gonna, chuck that one out.
So you're essentially offering yourself the flexibility to say this works, this doesn't,
and yeah,
giving yourself, you know, permission to leave behind what doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an active learner, so for me, I try it. I try something, and if it doesn't work, okay, cool. Yeah. There's other people like learn differently, so.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you mentioned before that you trained in Japan, especially when you were young, and then before you went to Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
How did you find dealing with different competition styles, as in, like, you know, in terms of how you're trying to develop your own judo, and what did your judo end up looking like, your stylistically?
Stylistically, I don't know what my judo is. I had a Japanese visitor at UNSW recently, and afterwards, I took him for a drink afterwards, and he said to me, oh, you're a Japanese judo style. And I've never at one moment thought that I've had Japanese judo. And I think you can agree with me that I don't have Japanese judo. Well, then, like, Kylie Koenig, who's the coach of Zoo Judo, and she said to me last night, oh, she was talking about me to Rob, saying, oh, he does this Georgian stuff. So, that's a good question. I just find, like, I've just got my judo, I think. I think, yeah, my judo is kind of all over the show. Not necessarily good judo, but it's all over the show. When I'm in Europe, my Yoka Tominari works really well. Whereas when I'm in Australia, Ojigari seems to work really well.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in Uzbekistan, Ojigari never works because you get counted every time you try it.
Yep.
So it's kind of different. For me, different things worked in different places.
Right. Does it actually end up being like an advantage to you because then you're able to adapt very quickly to different styles you're fighting?
Oh yeah, definitely. For up and coming judoka, I think training at different clubs is key because you'll learn different things, and even different clubs in from the same country train differently.
Yep.
And have different styles. So, you know, you want to get as much variety and exposure as you can. Yeah,
for sure. Looking back in retrospect over your career, is there anything which you would have done differently or improved upon now that you've got that hindsight sort of factor?
Oh, yeah, a lot. Especially in my teenage years, I would have just tried pretty much when I was doing randori, I would have just tried different techniques. And when I was doing technical sessions as a teenager, I would have done different things.
What are maybe one or two of the key things that you
changed? I mentioned earlier the situation on randori, right, with my training partner. But yeah, pretty much expose myself to different things earlier. So I would have tried, you know, done one randori. You can quite easily do this at your own clubs or whoever's listening. You can do one randori where you go a top right hand grip, and then the next randori you fight top left hand grip, and then next randori you fight left handed, next randori you go Russian style, Mongolian style. There's a million things you can do, like handicap yourself and learn that way. Especially if you're one of the better people at your club and you're not, you know, there's nothing really to gain if you're a black belt and you're fighting a green belt and you throw them with the whole Goku, you're not really developing.
Yeah, and interesting that you mentioned like almost to handicap yourself, which sort of feels like, you know, as if you're injured in one way, because Ronda Rousey actually developed her jujigatami because she had torn her ACL, and that was the only thing she could do. She just drills jujigatami every day.
Yeah.
So situational randori is something you would have implemented a bit more. Maybe growing up as you're moving into international judo and really elite sort of stuff, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Yeah, I would have taken a coach with me every day.
Sometimes not always within your control, though.
Yeah, that wasn't within my control.
So how did you? This is another tangent. You're just gonna have to go with it. How did you cope not having that coach? How did you?
Generally, most places you go, the person. Judo is a big family, so it's quite nice. Wherever you go, the coach will look after you and give you advice. For example, I fought for New Zealand before, I fought for New Zealand my whole career, but I've had, Dusseldorf in 2016, the Grand Prix in Dusseldorf, I had the Serbian national coach in my chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'd met him and I'd trained in Serbia a fair bit. And I've had competitions where the Croatia coach was in my chair as well. Like, I speak Serbian and Croatian, so that helps.
Yeah.
I've had a competition in Uzbekistan where I had an Uzbek in my chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't understand a word he was saying to me. I mean, yeah. So,
but you've been having that support, right?
Yeah, but it's just, someone's there, someone's supporting you, and it goes a long way.
Yeah.
So most places where you go, the coach will give you advice, especially if it's a club.
Yeah.
International training camp, if you're there on your own, you're on your own.
Yeah.
But if you're training in a club, you know, people will help you.
Yeah.
And people know you, they'll help you, I tend to think, yeah.
Yeah. So sort of key points to take away from that is implement more situational randori, and secondly, try and have a coach if possible.
Yeah.
If not, make as many friends as you can so one of them can stand in your
coach. Yeah. Yeah, be friendly, that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just as we sort of maybe begin to wrap up the podcast, just a couple of sort of spontaneous questions. So, after you weigh in, what's your favorite food? Because I've seen some of your Instagram posts.
Oh, no. My Instagram posts are pretty much trolling people who eat really healthy.
Yeah. Okay. One of them, I've got it here. It says, it was a photo, and it was literally patty, egg, patty, cheese, patty, mayo, patty.
Wait, what? There's no carbs in that. There's no carbs in that. It's, I wouldn't recommend that for anyone's diet, but, No, to be honest, after weighing, because nowadays in judo you weigh in the night before. After weighing, I'd get a high carb meal just to put me to sleep. And also the fact is generally I probably hadn't eaten carbs in a week leading up to weighing. So probably like a pasta or a rice meal after weighing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I got carried away and had like a milkshake and stuff just because I could indulge, but I don't recommend it.
Right, okay. And if you, I suppose this is very applicable considering you're a coach now, if you have, you know, a white belt who is, say, the athletic background, so they can move and stuff, so they've taken on judo and they've got maybe a competition that they want to do in a couple of weeks. You can only teach them one throw or one technique standing on their mother. What would it be?
There's two answers to that. Depends on the person. Oh, is it like that's one answer?
Yeah, let's go completely average. He's average height. He or she is average height.
It might be Uranagi or Takatoshi. I heard bring up Kylie. And Kylie from Zoo Judo, she told me an interesting stat yesterday that 11% of the last Olympic Games, 11% of direct attacks were successful, whereas 30% of counter attacks were successful. So yeah, maybe it's a counter. Maybe a counter is the way to go.
Yeah, that actually makes sense, considering if they've just started, they probably aren't that great at initiating their own attacks.
Yeah, they don't know how to move yet. They don't know how to set up an opportunity. So I personally don't think someone who's got a white belt should be competing after 2 weeks, you know, but I don't teach counters to white belts generally. I generally try to teach positive, aggressive judo.
Yeah.
This is a hypothetical.
Hypothetical
maybe,
to sort of see what is the sort of key thing that you start
implementing
more in a competition.
Maybe Tanya Toshi or Uranagi.
Yeah.
Uranagi, maybe. Yeah.
Cool. And you mentioned before your world championship Ippon in 10 seconds, but do you have any other key fights that you'd maybe say is really a good reflection of your judo or any favourite fights?
No, not really. there's some memories of fights that stick with you, but I don't know if they're a reflection of my judo. I don't know.
Okay, what are the fights that stuck with you?
I mentioned Sean Choi. There's a moment when I beat him. That was a good moment. So, you know, because he was always a guy I look up to, and I trained with him for years, and you know, he'd always beaten me. You know, it was a big thing to get that monkey off my back, sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
There's also Mark Brewer and I were rivals in the New Zealand team for a while, and then I think I had slightly better international results, but whenever I fought him in 81s, I wasn't at 100%. And then the last one we had, I did beat him, so that was kind of a...
What competition was that?
That was at Oceania, but I kind of, I think he'd just come back from injury, so I kind of knew I was going to beat him. He's coming back from injury, he shouldn't be as sharp as he can be.
So there's an expectation that he's not performing yet.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that was kind of another monkey off the back. But then there's other times where, you fight and nothing goes your way. So, yeah. Sorry, I didn't really answer that question.
what's the fight that somebody can look up then? So if we go with the one you fought, Mark, what year was the Oceania Championships?
That was in 2015.
2015 Oceania Championships.
Yeah, that was a bronze medal fight. So it wasn't where I wanted to be anyway. It was more a consolation prize than anything. So in judo, you have a lot of disappointing days. Unless you're Teddy Riner, I think.
Yeah, okay. And so last thing, so as you're coaching now, what's some of the advice that you give to, so maybe choose one or two key pieces of advice you give to Australian or Kiwi cadets coming up into competitions?
One, do as much judo as possible, which for a lot of people means going out of your club and going to other clubs, and just expose yourself as much, to as much judo as you can. Like literally, if you're a cadet in New Zealand or Australia, you're probably doing judo 4 times a week max. You need to be doing judo pretty much every day, and a lot of training on session on top of that. Yeah, so do as much judo as possible is one. And two, probably don't be afraid to fail. Try lots of new things while you're doing judo. Experiment. Never feel comfortable. Never feel comfortable in randori. Constantly try new stuff. That's the best way to develop, I think. Yeah, that's...
Cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty solid advice. I've got a lot in there. I'm going to take out the conversation and be like, okay, situational rainbow. so great. Thank you so much, Vitsa, for coming on the show today.
That's right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Nothing better to do on Saturday afternoon than talk about judo.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation with Vitsa. Vitsa is now based in Sydney and coaches at the University of New South Wales Judo Club, as well as having recently taken up a role as a New Zealand national coach. He offers personalised coaching within the Sydney area, and I would personally recommend at least one of these sessions because, as you've just heard, he's got some of the freshest feet-on-the-ground knowledge of elite international judo in all of New South Wales. So the fastest way to get in touch with Vitsa is just to send him a message on Facebook. That's linked in the show notes, or give him a quick Facebook search, that's Vitsa Pavlenich, and simply message him saying that you heard him on the Judo Edit podcast. Thanks for listening to the second episode. For all of the latest updates and exciting news of when the next episode will be released, follow the Judo Edit Facebook page. Otherwise, this is Melissa Budiato signing off.